following program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.
This is Charles Ruas. The next program presents Richard Foreman, playwright, director, and founder of the Ontological Hysteric Theater. This program from my archives was recorded in 1975 and broadcast on WBAI in New York.
At a certain point, when I was beginning, just before my first production, I decided I needed a name. And I must admit, I was sort of inspired because at that time in New York, I was deeply involved with the activities of Jonas Mekas's Cinematheque and so forth, and Hermann Nietzsche, an Austrian who does theatrical events where he cuts up dead animals and pours blood all over the place, was doing an event in the Cinematheque. And I was thinking for a name, and I saw this gigantic poster of Nietzsche's with the big carcass on it. It said, Hermann Nietzsche.
Richard Foreman. On the Ontological Hysteric Theater.
Standard situation, which I then thought I would try to redeem, as it were, by opening holes in it and letting cosmic influences and concerns, ontological concerns, bleed through. Ontology, of course, being, in philosophy, the study of the state of being rather than the study of individual beings. The isness of the tree is green. I think that the name still works and is still relevant because I think that those 19th century naturalistic triangle
situations... You're listening to Richard Foreman, creator of the Ontological Hysteric Theater, in an interview by Charles Ruas. In the course of the program, excerpts from the rehearsal of his latest play, Pandering to the Masses, a Misrepresentation, will be heard in the background.
...of our normal ways of thinking about psychological tensions and so forth with ontological cosmic concerns. All kinds of other concerns, for that matter.
Richard, how long have you been performing in New York with the Ontological Hysteric Theater?
The first production that I ever did was in 1968, in the spring of 68, at the Cinematheque, which is now the anthology that Jonas Mekas runs down on Worcester Street. That's how long.
That's how long.
Since then, there have been generally at least two plays a year.
And is your latest play, Pandering to the Masses, a continuum of the plays you were working on in 68?
Or in a sense, I've been writing one play all these years.
Hugh!
What you are watching at the present moment is the prologue to the play entitled Pandering to the Masses, a Misrepresentation, in which a certain intellectual context is made visible for the audience to that work. The play itself, Pandering to the Masses, a Misrepresentation, will begin in perhaps 5 minutes.
It's less clear to me when I was beginning, but in retrospect, it's certainly clear, and now I don't hesitate to admit and deal with that fact. The characters, of course, are always the same, and the basic situation that I want to treat of is basically the same. They are always plays about, I won't say myself, but they're always plays about trying to get it together in one's head, trying to make it clear for oneself. Now, that oneself, of course, is sort of myself, but I take it that my own efforts and stumblings and difficulties and slight successes in that area are typical, universal, have to do with what a lot of other people are into. Very often I get in discussions where we talk about the extreme privateness of the nature of my work and of the references in my work. In a sense that's true, but in another sense I think I'm aiming at something quite different because I'm trying to write from a level about a substructure or a superstructure that is a shared superstructure of consciousness.
Then are you saying that the character in the play is a direct biographical reference to you?
No. I'm saying that increasingly these days, my writing is an attempt to notate day by day where I am. I'm trying to notate the geography of my presence in life, you know, in New York City, having read all the books that I'm currently reading, seeing the people that I'm seeing. Now, I think that where I am at this moment, you see, is not a Richard Foreman in terms of the way we are trained to think about other personalities, you see. I think bleeding through Richard Foreman and where he is at this moment are all kinds of other people, all kinds of other influences. So in a sense, it's a distortion to say that I'm writing about myself. The meeting point of many vectors from different sources.
Let me ask you the symmetrical reverse question. Is the artist that's central, the artist writer that's often reappears in your play, does that mean that in private you view yourself as a playwright or artist or performer or director?
Yes.
Experiencing these various currents?
Yeah.
From day to day?
You know, my identity for myself, I suppose, is someone who's trying to make something out of the materials of his life and his experience. It is interesting in a sense that, you know, the focus of the work has slightly shifted because for the last few years, in the beginning, the plays were very clearly about Max at the center.
Yes.
They are shifting to be about Rhoda
to be
more
about
and more
Rhoda
at the center.
Ladies and gentlemen, this play at its center tells of Rhoda, who is still off stage, and her introduction into a secret society which dispenses a very particular kind of knowledge, which Rhoda learns to endure, which Max, who sits up center, learns to write about. This knowledge has to do with energy, effort, difficulty, awkwardness, failure, and then effort renewed.
That has to do with the fact that I've been working with Kate Manheim for four years. I don't remember exactly how long. You know, in a sense, it's almost become a kind of collaboration on that level, for all kinds of reasons. I mean, I also live with Kate Manheim, but for all kinds of reason, that collaboration has sort of shifted, in certain ways, the focus of the piece.
From Max to Rhoda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Rhoda first appears in the Sophia sequence of plays.
You know, I just don't remember. Because, first of all, when Rhoda first appeared, it was not as if this was a new character appearing. It was a new name that was describing one of the same archetypal female figures that had appeared since the very beginning.
He's putting everything he knows into his play.
Everything.
He always puts everything he knows into every play he writes. In this play, for instance, you will see that the naked Sophia and the naked Eleanor are in possession of a certain kind of knowledge to which Rhoda, not yet certain that she needs or desires it, will be soon painfully initiated.
Everything
is
easy
to come
by.
For
easy
did
you
know
that
for
as
I
reached
instant
for
my
gloves
inside
the
did drawer.
You didn't exactly reach for them, Rhoda.
I noticed a letter addressed to me lying inside the cabinet.
Here!
Rhoda does not know still what is expected of her. Rivals in knowledge. If she is alone against the striped wall of her own living room, are her experiences and her anticipations any the less full of imaginary fears, body experiences? The stripes have something to do with her body. The letter she finds has something to do with her nervousness.
I don't really remember which text the actual name first appeared in.
What about the name Sophia for your sequence of plays? That ran over a period of several years.
Sophia keeps reappearing in all the plays, even the plays that are not officially part of that Sophia sequence. It first happened, let's see, well, at that time I was reading a lot of Gnostic writing, and of course Sophia in the Gnostic tradition is the female personification of wisdom. One of the subjects, one of the recurrent subjects in the work has always been the Max figure, the writer figure, who's sometimes the Ben figure, too, by the way. That shifts back and forth. But the writer figure dealing with femininity, in essentially polarized terms, you know, either an Earth Mother erotic object, yeah, vis-a-vis a more muse-like object. Not to say that those two don't get mixed, and the plays are generally a playing off of those two abstract concepts and showing how there are contradictions within them and so forth, the writer character experiences.
Does the fact that all of the characters return, does that structure the sequence of plays?
No, you see, when I write, essentially, I'm talking to myself. I'm just, so, you know, I'm saying, huh, you know, I'm dealing with my own perceptions in the act of writing and in the moment of writing. Like, we are sitting here and I might say something to myself about, you know, there's the microphone. Then I might have a second thought. And somehow, for me, that second thought is coming from a reconstituted Richard a few seconds later from the first thought. Now, perhaps it's inertia, perhaps, I don't know exactly why, but I still sort of think of that in terms of different people, and I just automatically end up having it come through the faintly sensed images of these characters that I've been using for the last, 6 years.
It's curious, then, how do you separate the fact that you've been working with the same characters and also the same group of actors and actresses?
Yes, but that changes more than many companies. In other words, I have a pool of people who've worked with me quite a bit, but that's always fluid and changing. You know, there's some people who now are working with me who've worked with me for about 6 years. And then in every play that I do, there are generally some people that are in it for the first time. So it's not a fixed company the same way that Andre Gregory's company, Richard Schechner's company. But it's a pool of people from which I draw.
From what you say, one might expect you to use the actors in terms of their personality, when actually in the staging, quite the contrary occurs. You seem to use the actors more as figures of your imagination.
Well, you see, I don't agree. I think that I do use the actors in terms of their personalities. You see, for me, the process of making the piece is a two-stage process. There's the writing of it, and then there's the trying to clarify in the staging what I have written. The writing of it is me having this dialogue with myself, where a different me succeeds the first me each moment. I would say, you know, I don't write characters on that level. When I'm writing the play, I write names, because I just know that there's a Hannah, there's a Max, and I don't think about them as characters. I think about them more as names, as masks almost, and I'm not sure what's behind the mask. Now, when it comes time to stage the work, I want the particular presence of the actor, his quality, the particular people I've chosen, to be sort of a stumbling block for the text.
Associative experiment in the art of our era.
Bring that forward foot more to the wall. The forward one, the one near the wall. The one near the wall, bring it more to the wall. Lean in, bend that arm, and lift the thing a little higher on the wall. That's it. So you get a little closer to the wall like that. And really lean into the wall. Okay? No, you can get higher. But the way you were was just right. Like that.
Because for me, what is interesting is human effort, you know, a human project that then stumbles over something real out there in the environment that resists the purely imagined project. And from that collision between the dream or the project or the idea and the piece of reality that it stumbles over, which in this case is the real actor, something alive results from that collision, from that stumbling. And I think that my pieces are built on that kind of collision. Just as consciousness, which is what I'm basically interested in, arises when an organism starts moving outward and runs into something, and then self-consciousness arises.
But the audience's consciousness comes from its going into the stage, into the play, and encountering your consciousness, rather than the actor's individuality.
I think that people experience more than one thing at a time and experience on more than one level. And I want them to experience both those things. I want them to be in a heightened state of noticing. And I think that in that heightened state of noticing, it's the juxtaposition, it's the interplay, it's the counterpoint between all the different levels of things going on that is exciting and wakes one up and makes one feel good in watching the work of art.
Yes, I'm referring to the fact that in your stage setting, so many lines are pre-recorded and actually spoken by the actors and actresses. and that their movements are always somehow framed by either the stage setting or the metronome, which times their action or gives it, adds a sense of timing to whatever movements they may be making. Also, your use of strings to focus on their gestures or their poses directs the audience's viewing to what you think is essential in the performance.
Yes, but I'm...
To that extent, controls...
Oh, sure.
The actors...
You see, the only reason I say that is because there are people who do work, you know, and their stated purpose is to sort of dehumanize the performer as a performer, or even somebody like Nicolai. Now, I am not interested in uber marionettes or, you know, robots. I am interested in the rigor of my design and the rigor of my directing the audience's attention. But another textural element is the particular physical presence that is Kate Mannheim or Bob Fleischner as opposed to somebody else. I would never want to have my actors be interchangeable. And it's very interesting also because sometimes I have to replace people. And the person who replaces someone always shifts the focus and the feel of the scenes that he's in. And I don't want to minimize that.
If we're speaking of Kate Mannheim, doesn't she give a particular style to the way in which you use the other actors? I've heard her performance compared to the performance of a silent film.
Mm-hmm. It may influence the other actors to the extent that maybe some of them are looking at her and thinking, oh, I'd like to try doing it sort of like that. Maybe that's the way to do it.
What's in this letter?
No.
It invites me to join a certain society.
What society?
A certain society concerned with knowledge.
I'm not interested.
In knowledge?
It's a dead end.
Don't be so sure.
Knowledge, she decides, is a dead end.
But, of course, it's not conscious and it's not willed on my part because I do not speak to the actors very much in terms of what kind of performance they should give. I speak to them only in terms of, well, the choreography, as it were. But within that choreography, which of course is very carefully worked out, I don't want them to develop a particular style except their own style. I want them to be more themselves, dealing with the problem of, okay, how do I walk across the room? You know, how do I open the door? How do I fall down? I'm concerned with each of them being uniquely themselves and doing all of those tasks.
But while doing the task, they somehow have to fit within the composition that you establish for each scene.
Oh, well, I'll make sure that they do, because most of them being themselves is stuff that they don't notice. I don't use professional trained actors in general, because I'm interested in what is revealed of people when they are not trying to perform in quite the same way that a trained actor is. You see, I'm interested again, I spoke about that stumbling over reality that is so important to me. And I'm interested, in a sense, in their stumblings, in their effort, in their doing something. I think it was Yvonne Rainer that said many years ago that someone doing something is more interesting than the reason that they are doing it.
Bandaged my hand myself.
You
think
I
can't
write
it
was
a
decision
that
was
not
my
decision.
Right.
Recapitulation. He bandaged it himself. His writing has
Glove. Two.
Third.
Bandage.
Text.
Text.
Match.
What?
Counts.
Not.
Music.
Not.
Life.
Not. Not.
Ideas.
Not.
What?
Decor.
Not.
Counts.
No, not.
Yeah, it does.
It does, all right, yeah, all right, that's the cue.
So, would you say cue?
No.
It's just a buzz?
It's just a buzzer. Okay. It's the buzzer after text, that's what counts, not music, not decor, not.
Buzz.
Yeah.
To me, acting, as it classically is trying to help the audience see behind the act. The performer is trying to perform the action in such a way that the audience can say, oh, yes, I see why he picks up the teacup and throws it at his wife. And I'm much more interested in my particular actors doing that the way that they do it and not implying that behind it there's a whole history.
Other than your actors, the stage often seems to be a stronger presence than the individual performers themselves, to the
extent that
the stage is constantly performing around them.
Yes, I'm interested in composition on all levels. It's how things are put together with other things, how things are in relation to other things. It's interesting because in the early days, when I first originated the name ontological hysteric, my interests were much more phenomenological, and I was much more interested in isolating a gesture or an object, placing it there, having the audience deal with that over a period of time, and seeing it bracketed, as it were, in isolation to try and get the essence of the apple. I'm not interested in that anymore. I am now interested only in the web of ever-changing relations between things, which I think defines things now anyway, and I no longer believe in the phenomenological bracketing.
Do you feel like giving a description of the stage setting of Pandering?
Oh, it's 60, 70. The stage is 70, what, 80 feet deep? It's a steep rake.
Announcing the end.
The hill that people roll down at the back. There are walls that slide in and out from the sides. It's a machine. You know, in the constructivist sense, it's a machine for making a play, for presenting a play to an audience. I think it's neat. Elegant. It's brown, which, you know, my plays have always been brown. Next year it's going to be different. Of course, I may change my mind, but I think next year is the big breakaway from brown.
What about all the props that you use? Are they significant in themselves, ranging from plastic roses to fruits to pies to...
They're not significant in themselves.
Gold
in any
fans.
Well, I think of the props no differently than I think of the words, than I think of the actors. It's all part of trying to chart the energy forces at work, plus the obstacles they run into. Because my props, generally, I like them to have sort of a homemade look, so that even the prop shows the effort that went into making it or figuring out how to make it.
Are you saying they all exist within the same field? The word, the actor, the prop, the stage?
That's a tricky point. You see, they do exist within the same field, but they are not homogenous. This relates to the problem I have in trying to make a film. Because when I think of making... You see, my plays are constantly interrupted. And I do think of, you know, a funny new prop coming on as interrupting the action. When I think of making a film, all the normal devices that interrupt in the theater become swamped by sheer texture of the fact that this light is being projected on the screen. They all turn to shadows of the same density, and there's no way to interrupt it. To interrupt it, I'd have to have somebody in the auditorium stand up and, you know, hold something up against the screen. So they are in the same field, but that field is a field of, you know, mutually interpenetrating fields from different places somehow.
Actually, your conception of the film is that it is, unlike the stage, it is a two-dimensional.
Well, it makes everything end up being of the same substance, you see. And actually, I see, in answer to your question, yes, there is a field, the field of the play. And into this field come objects from all kinds of different places. When they meet in the field, they create a moment which is a slight moment of aesthetic illumination or what have you. See, those, I think those are the real objects that are produced in this field are little epiphanies of awareness. But the objects entering this field come from all kinds of different places and are made of different material.
In your early plays, you projected a narrative onto the walls and onto screens. Now, the loudspeaker seems to perform that function. That is, your voice coming over the loudspeaker seems to give a narrative and a continuity to the play.
Well, that was strongest in this last piece, Pandering to the Masses, of course. And I point out that it was called Pandering to the Masses, even though the subtitle was a misrepresentation. Though it is true that for a number of years, I have said that I was more interested in making my own kind of learning pieces, almost, in the Brechtian sense. I try to write plays and to stage plays that reflect, as I said before, exactly where I am at a present moment. And where I have been at, I must admit, for these past 2 years, has been increasing frustration that even though the work has been getting better known, and even though there is a larger group of people now who professes interest and admiration for it, nevertheless, even amongst the people who like the work, very often I was described as a kind of neo-Dadaist who was, throwing things together that didn't make much sense and just trying to strike certain interesting effects off. Of course, that's not really my interest, and I feel that all the work that I've been doing has very clear centers of interests and is about all kinds of things in very rigorous ways. And in a sense, my increasing presence in the play as an explainer, though I admit an ironic explainer and a confusing explainer often, is a response to that frustration, thinking, my God, how can I make it simpler? How can I show you that the discourse that I'm presenting to you has its own logic, is not obscure, certainly is not obscure if one is familiar with the normal modes of discourse present in contemporary poetry, dance, advanced painting, and so forth.
And yet your work has become more popular as it's become more intricate.
As it's become more intricate, let's face it, it's become faster. I mean, in the simplest, silliest terms, the phenomenological interests that I had at the beginning meant that the work would be much more static because, an object would get placed on the table, there'd be a pause, there'd be a statement about the object, nothing would move. It would go on like that for 10 minutes, then there'd be a slight change and another 100 statements, Today, it moves faster and there are all kinds of changes so that at least on the, just on the musical, rhythmic level, there are always things popping in from doors and falling down and doing all kinds of things.
It's actually misleading to speak of you as having one style. I'm doing that because I love the Sophia play so much. Actually, I recall seeing Dr. C'est la Vie, which was a musical farce, basically, yeah. And very popular as well.
Less popular than seems to be the myth. I mean, they did keep it running, but it lost money. I mean, it ran for 3 months because they always thought it would catch on. But that was an amazing experience because we tried to do something that... Well, we tried to be popular, and we did everything conceivable to make it as clear as possible to everybody in that audience what was happening. Needless to say, most of the normal theatergoers who attended walked out, scratching their heads and doing worse and shouting out at the end, how much do we pay Clive Barnes and things like that, and the curtain calls. But it proved to me, that was as commercial as I could get, and I guess that's an impossibility.
Your first great success came with Sophia Part 3?
Well, I don't know how you define great success, because my first great success, as far as I was concerned, was the first play that I did at the old Cinematheque, Angel Face, where, I made it because I had been watching filmmakers make what I thought was very important art, and for many years I had been too scared to even tell them that I was sort of an artist, and I finally got the courage up to put on a play. I was rewarded, I felt, by being taken seriously by my peers of that time.
That's
my
ten. That's my ten.
Oh, Max. achieve certain things. Do you understand that if he is rewarded, you are all rewarded?
That was a tremendous success. Then down through the years, it's simply a matter, slowly the audiences have been growing. I think that the Sophia play that you're talking about, which I guess was The Cliffs,
yes,
was more successful, let's face it, directly because of the success of Dr. Saleeby, which happened at the same time. And I must say that I'm not one of those theater people who has particularly friendly feelings towards audiences and thinks, oh, well, the audience is right in the end, and, you know, trust your audience. I feel that's nonsense, unfortunately. I saw exactly what happened at that point. For the 3 years preceding Sophia, 70% of my audience would walk out after 20 minutes. Then Dr. Saleeby opened in the fall of whatever year it was, 72, I think, 71. And I had my picture in the paper and, you know, good reviews vis-a-vis that show. Sophia opened about a month after Dr. Saleeby. And all of a sudden, and I know that the show was not that different from the preceding shows, all of a sudden, nobody walked out. You know, a lot more people came. And one can draw one's own conclusions, but I've drawn mine.
But aren't you being a bit cynical?
No, I don't think I'm being cynical. I think I'm being realistic. That has nothing to do with my feeling of, you know, happiness and gratitude for the people that, you know, seriously are picking up on the work. You know, it's very difficult because I observe in myself, it's very hard not to respond to an artistic experience through the web of preconditioning that has been set up for you. And I'm sure that I myself have gone to all kinds of things with the wrong kind of preconditioning, the right kind of preconditioning, and it's influenced my ability to respond. The work of art is a contingent thing, and it is a historical accident placed within the historical accident of individual consciousness. They come together as an accident. And as time goes on, I'm less and less convinced about any ultimates and any really arbitrary absolutes in talking about that strange situation when a viewer's consciousness knocks up against this thing somebody has made for God knows what reason.
Richard, I wonder if you would give a description of the way you set a stage for the listeners.
Do you mean physically?
Yes. Because actually your theater makes it very difficult for you to move your company around,
yes,
doesn't it?
For me, staging the play is the placement of the gesture vis-a-vis the given architecture, which is a combination of the room and then what's been built in the room. What I hate in the theater is that notion, which is the prevalent notion, that somehow the most dramatic thing you can imagine is like a, for instance, a great big empty stage wreathed with shadows in the background and a pool of spotlight in the center suddenly picks out Hamlet, who launches into this soliloquy in space, as it were. You see, he's just floating there in this romantic, magnificent space. I'm very concerned with establishing a stage in which it is very clear where everything is vis-a-vis everything else. So the designs of my pieces are almost as if I would imply for the audience that all of this has to be seen through a grid. There's a kind of geometric, a kind of diagrammatic concern for the space, so that it's almost as if watching the play, you can chart each gesture and each action, you know, vector-like against the grid of the given, you know, background, foreground, the whole architecture of the space.
In Pandering to the Masses, you use an inclined stage. Is that for the sake of the perspective, to create a sense of infinity?
One doesn't arrive at something like that for reasons. In other words, I theorize, you know, to a fault, and I'm always, after the fact, thinking of what I'm doing and relating it to all kinds of other disciplines and things in order to justify to myself and to help explain to other people what I'm doing. In the moment of doing it, it's, you know, desperation and trying everything, and everything seems awful, and all of a sudden something pops into your head, and that seems right. I think that's always what it comes down to. Now, I do know that, anecdotally, the source of my interest in that steep rake was driving through France a couple of years ago in mountainous terrain, and I had never been to the mountains in America. And just something, I was just very moved by seeing the side of a mountain go up in front of me, and that making me feel queasy and doing something very funny to my sense of space. And I always wanted to use that experience, and this was the first time I had occasion to, really. I don't know. I forget exactly how it all came together with this particular play. It's just something. It's always something that happens, and then later on you try and explain and try and look for yourself what the sources were in your background that might have created that solution.
Is it significant at all that you have people rolling balls and actually tumbling down the incline?
No, it's just when you have that incline, you better use it. Sometimes. As a matter of fact, I have a friend who was very disappointed because he was the person who built it, and he came to see the play, and he was very disappointed because he was waiting to see shoes that were built so that when the actors came downstage, they wore one kind of shoe for going down mountains in which the front was built up very high and the heel was low, and then they'd change shoes and walk up with shoes with the heels very high and the tip low, and he was very disappointed.
You studied playwriting, didn't you?
Yeah, I was at Yale, at the drama school, back when John Gassner was teaching playwriting, before he died. And I got an MFA in playwriting, right?
Did you work at the Long Wharf?
Oh, no, the Long Wharf was not in existence. I mean, I graduated from Yale in 62, which was long before the Long Wharf.
So that you came to New York not specifically to do plays, but to do films?
Or? Oh, no, I came to New York specifically to do plays. But you see, I began going to the theater when I was perhaps 15. I would go every weekend. Even at that age, I would dislike most of what I saw. When I came to New York after leaving Yale, I still felt that somehow most of what I was seeing in the theater I thought was awful. And my dreams were of being, a Brecht or a Giraudoux or God knows what. And those people, of course, were essentially people that the American theater, as it then was rejecting all the time. And then accidentally in New York, at the Living Theater one night, they had a film show, and I don't know why I went, but they were showing the very early so-called underground films. And I was amazed. I was stunned, because here was somebody who was by himself making a movie, I don't know, just getting it all together by himself. Also, the work seemed very beautiful to me. So at that point, I started doing nothing except searching those films out. And very soon I was friendly with Jonas and with other people in the movement, and I used to be the most faithful patron. In the early days of the New American Cinema, I think that nobody except Jonas saw as many films as I did. I saw everything. It's strange, I never seriously got involved with making a film or even thinking about making a film, because I always felt I was going to make plays, and gradually I had the courage to make my own play in the same way that these people were making their own films.
So that the cinematic analogy isn't accidental at all?
No.
You are seeing the stage as a screen or a grid, as you put it.
No, because the main reason that I can't work in films is that I do think of everything in very three-dimensional plastic terms, and somehow I've often thought I should make a movie and, started planning it, and then I always stop. I must say that the import of the films aesthetically to me was that I had spent my youth, being a young kid growing up in Scarsdale and then going to Brown and going to Yale and feeling sort of out of it and always imagining that to write a play I had to write and rewrite and rewrite so that my voice, which I did not like, my inflection, which I did not like, would end up sounding like Arthur Miller's inflection or Brecht's inflection or whoever I was interested in at the particular time. Now, all of a sudden, I started seeing these films where the people were embracing the most awkward aspect of themselves. At least that's the way I read it at that time. And it gave me the courage to base my plays on exactly those elements that I was trying to rewrite out because they didn't seem professional enough, because they didn't seem slick enough. It gave me the courage to build upon my difficulties and my idiosyncrasies. So that complete flip-flop, I think, was, you know, the most important aesthetic influence and lesson of my life.
The filmmakers you're speaking of, are they Kenneth Anger and those early?
In the early days, the people that were most important to me were Ken Jacobs, Jack Smith, above all, Ron Rice, the very early days. Then, of course, there were many others, Jonas and Michael Snow and even Warhol and George Landau, Ernie Gier, the whole many, many different filmmakers. I was very deeply immersed in learning from them, both a certain aesthetic and learning to have courage, which more and more as time goes on, I think is the crucial element in making art.
Because you began staging plays to sort of embrace certain aspects of yourself, and you use non-professionals in your company, do you think of yourself as doing theater or performances?
Oh, I think of myself as doing theater. Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I think of myself as being much closer to everything, to, you know, to great classical theater than most other experimental theater.
The old theater would prove to you that Max is dancing the way that he is dancing, by which is meant his motives proven real and genuine, and you are convinced in a way appropriate to the theater.
Because most other experimental theater that's going on today comes out of a kind of post-Grotowski tradition that I think lacks the interest in a very kind of intellectual irony that is the basis of classical theater, that I think displaced to other areas is still the main appeal of my theater, a kind of multi-layered point seen in relation to other point.
Is it this visual dimension that has prevented you from publishing your plays?
No, I would say it's much more lack of interest on the part of publishers. Though I think Pandering to the Masses, negotiations now that are almost concluded for it to be in an anthology, a small anthology of this kind of work that's coming out next year. I think that the reason the plays haven't been published are just the standard reasons why, you know, experimental literature by relatively unknown people doesn't get published.
You would make a separation between avant-garde theater and off-Broadway theater.
Well, this is a difficult point for me to speak about because there's so little in any theater that I see that relates to my interests. I wouldn't really make a distinction because I do think of myself as operating with the same tools on the same subject matter that, you know, most of the going interesting poets, painters, what have you, are operating. And I think of experimental theater as simply having other interests, primarily because theater is usually focused upon the performer and the personality and the magnetism of the performer. That is the center, even for most avant-garde theater, of the event. And that's simply not what I'm interested in.
By contrast, you're more interested in the consciousness that you present in the staging of the play.
Yes, I'm interested in compositional arrangements. I'm interested in waking the audience up in terms of structures that they can perceive being offered to them on the stage and how those structures interact, resonate, and are in counterpoint to the structure of their own, like, ongoing watching it. I'm very conscious when I make the piece of my own rhythms of watching and trying to make a kind of music in counterpoint to my rhythms of watching.
What about the subject matter of your plays, which deal specifically with the act of the problems of the artist and the artist's consciousness?
It's very interesting. I was out in San Diego while we were taking a little vacation from this play. I was doing a little play out there, and I was talking to someone out there who was writing a piece on the scripts. And we sat down, and it became very clear as we talked about each of these plays that each play was really about a different subject, like any plays, as opposed to many people who've always thought that, oh, they're just about nothing, or they're all about to... They obviously all are about consciousness making art. That is a subtext for all the plays. But each of the plays focuses on a different way into that problem, and they are structured, we concluded jointly, having this discussion, that the structuring was akin to the kind of structure that somebody like G. Wilson Knight perceives when he talks about Shakespeare's in terms of clusters of ideas, when he's speaking about the language of Shakespeare. And in the same way, I think that there are clusters of configurations around certain subjects in my pieces. One piece might be sort of about energy and how that relates to the creative process and so forth. Another piece might be what work means, with the implications what it means to be a worker or a person who doesn't have to work, and that kind of thing, vis-a-vis the creative process and the thinking process. Subject, which is the subject of making art, which I think is no different from the subject of making your head, making yourself be awake moment to moment.
The awe of recognition announces the beginning of the play. Fear.
Cue!
Which happens to Rhoda in the center of the play entitled Pandering to the Masses, a Misrepresentation.
Richard Foreman speaking about the ontological hysteric theater in an interview with Charles Ruas. This program was produced by Janine Cooper with remote taping by Richard Harris. Technical assistance by David Marks. Thank you for listening.
This is Charles Ruas. You've been listening to a selection from my historic archives.
With the cooperation of Clock Tower, these programs have been restored for broadcast on Clock Tower Radio, operating at clocktower.org.
The previous program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.